Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained procrastination in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which according to the Prime Minister John Key is good for the economy, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest is, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, is it Robbie Kaiviti?
Robbie Kaiviti, indeed, thank you, Vinny. Means native, actually.
Indeed. Well, Robbie, would you just elaborate a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Love the intro first, Vinny. Love the music, mate. Lovely to catch up with you finally. Absolutely. I've been dying to bang into you at some point. My name's Robbie Kaiviti. I'm the leader of the New Zealand People's Mandate Party here in New Zealand, a newly formed party, and we're something with a little bit of a difference. NZPMP is the only party that's closely aligned itself to the Occupy movement, the Robin Hood movement, and the 350 movement. Your turn.
All right. Well, let's explain those kind of things as to how you indeed got into them.
Oh, fair enough. NZPMP has, myself personally, I've been around in politics a very long time now, at the blunt end of politics, really. I've been involved in community issues now here in New Zealand for a great many years. And the party was simply formed on the basis that we've realised that if we really want the kind of change that people are calling for in the Occupy movement, then the only thing we can really do to assist that change would be to try and change the system from within. So that means that NZPMP will be standing at the next election. But if we're successful, we want to introduce a completely new model for our governance here in New Zealand.
What is the new governance model that you propose?
Okay, what we're basically proposing is very simply this, that the people of this country certainly deserve to have a voice in government, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to put in place the systems that allow that to give people very direct control over their own governance. There's a number of ways of achieving that. We, as a party, already engage with the people on a very intimate level. And that sort of thing needs to continue inside government. We have to get away beyond this electorate system and submission system that we have. People need to have a much greater, or take a much greater responsibility in their own governance than they are. It's just not good enough to turn up on voting day, put a couple of ticks in a box, and then race off and bitch about what the country's doing for the next 3 years. Our people actually need to take responsibility for their own governance if they genuinely want the change that they say they want. The model is actually based around a Melanesian principle. It's called the Great Circle, where Parliament isn't structured at all the way it is now. It's based on
like a beehive controlled by a queen.
that's very aptly put, actually, Vinny. I've got some lingering doubts about poor old John there, to be quite honest. But no, the queen bee is absolutely about right. What we want to do is we basically want to restructure Parliament in a very very radical kind of way. The Melanesian Great Circle system is based very simply on the circle principle where, you see this in villages. This is where I first learned about the Great Circle, was sitting in the the company of my own family at Christmas time and asking my grandfather, why does everybody sit in the circle? And he explained it simply as this, that everybody sits in a circle and ideas are exchanged. And this is how young people get their education, actually, is you float into these circles. Every now and then one great old ham-hocked aunt would grab you and pull you into this wonderful circle and smother you with Fijian kisses, which are quite unpleasant, actually. And you would get...
Are they anything like... Are they Fijian kisses anything like the Glasgow kiss?
No. They're a good deal more affectionate, but unfortunately very sloppy and not something a young chap really wants in front of his mates. But you would get your education this way. There was nothing left out. You'd learn about life and love by listening and by receiving these little lessons as your day sort of progressed.
And what happens when the schools are banned hugging like they have now?
Oh, good Lord, I know. You know, we're becoming a... we sort of have a system now where we have this forced lack of affection. It bothers me entirely, you know, because I come from a place that's very loving, it's very inclusive, it draws you in and hugs you all the time. And I really don't understand that kind of mentality, and to be honest, I don't want to.
It's probably because you're not a deranged psychopath. You actually have empathy for other people.
Well, I don't know where it comes from. I come from a strange place, really. My father is Danish Nordic stock, so he gave me my looks. And my mother's a Belle of Fiji, so she gave me my culture. But so I have this curious world I live in where I float between the Pākehā world and the Melanesian world and a whole lot of others besides, because we're such a multicultural family. And that kind of brings me down to New Zealand, really. I see New Zealand the same way. We're a multicultural family here. And the bicultural conversation, as it's been happening in this country for the past couple of hundred years, well, we've kind of got to get away from that because we've never been a bicultural country. We've been a multicultural country for a very, very long time now.
Now, going back to governance, the Great Circle, how does it work in Parliament?
Well, there's no sides in a circle, Vinny, so it would be that if NZPMP was successful in gaining the government seats, you would well find that we would take the other parties into our caucus directly to make a direct contribution. The way the model is created, I mean, you avoid certain things. You avoid this kind of bickering that goes on in Parliament, because in the Great Circle it's quite impolite to do that. People get their turn to speak. This infighting that goes on between parties simply wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be allowed to exist, because it would be incumbent on all the parties to come to an agreement over those important issues. If they can't do that, then there would be consequences. It leads one to start asking the hard questions of all of the parties. If you're not going to put yourself in a position where you're cooperating, then perhaps it's time to go to the people over an important issue and have a referendum and let the people decide.
So let me get this straight. Under that form of government, any backwards politician who won't be convinced of anything, despite all the evidence being put out, yet instead you have the people's say instead of his.
That's correct. That's very basically, that's what would happen. I call it the Great Circle. The Swiss use a very similar system. They've been using it very successfully for years, where they have a system of binding referendum on important social issues. So, yes, if we got to that point where a certain politician is just prefers to just stick his head or her head in the mud and just simply not cooperate, there would be consequences for that politician. One of the things our model has built into it is that we actually have two prime ministers. The position of deputy prime minister would simply cease to exist. We would have two prime ministers. One would have day-to-day control over government, as the Prime Minister does now, in that very traditional sense. But the other Prime Minister of equal seniority would be the people's representative in Parliament, and that person would run a new office called the People's Advocacy Office, and it would cover all of those social services within the social services sphere, so that people have very direct conversation with government. They can very direct their problems, and that person's job and that department's job is to make sure that the people are served. At the moment, we've got a case of government rules and not a case of government serves, and we need to get away from that.
How many laws are being passed per day exactly? I heard it was two a day since the National Party came into power.
Somebody did a little, they worked it out. They worked out that if you place the pages of law on top of each other, the pile reaches 17 metres. And it's got to a point where...
Holy cow. How much control over a population can you fit into a 17-metre spined book?
Well, this is a... And if you start reading tomorrow, Vinny, you'd be going until you're well past, eh? We can't afford to go on creating ridiculous law. Some of the laws that have been passed lately just absolutely amaze me. We've got the Search and Surveillance Bill. Oh, lordy, lordy, what can I say about the Search and Surveillance Bill? It's the most serious attack on New Zealanders' rights and freedoms in our entire political history. It's a law that seeks to control. It creates a true police surveillance state here in this country. And one has to simply ask the question, what for? Who are they protecting us from? Because I'm darned if I've seen any terrorists coming through Mungaree Airport just lately. And I even those guys, the police out there, I wish they'd take their Glocks off them, because if it ever does happen, there's going to be a massacre if ever one of those guys decides to pull his gun. No, honestly, we're just not threatened here. The reality is our security requirements haven't changed since the 1950s. With one proviso, things have actually got better for New Zealand in terms of our security, because we're not under the old Cold War. So our security requirements haven't changed, and yet they keep pouncing on us and driving these new laws, which are all based on control of the populace. That's all they're for.
It's Agenda 21 protocol. They're taken over. In fact, John Key once said in a press conference that what he's doing is changing a lot of little things all over the place instead of any big things that would get people's attention up. And at the end of it, you accomplish quite a lot.
Well, in the end, he has accomplished quite a lot. If I was John Key, I would be particularly happy with what I've managed to accomplish. But the things that he has accomplished are so corrosive to the society that, frankly, all I can say is I think the guy is borderline criminal culpable, if you want my opinion. He's sitting right there on the very edge of doing some things that could be seen to be extremely wrong.
What do you expect? And, he used to be a derivatives trader for a major US corporate bank that has shares in the Federal Reserve and finances both parties in the States.
he's a strange animal. All corporate beasts are basically a strange animal. John, I don't know. When I look at the man's eyes, you know, there have been times in this country where things have happened, circumstances that should require from a Prime Minister great emotion. And when I look at John Key's eyes, when he's talking about the deaths of some troops in Afghanistan, or when he's talking about the Pike River miners, I look at the guy and I see the smile and I look at his eyes and I think, your eyes are dead, mate. You're absolutely flipping dead. There's just nothing going on. And when you hear him talk about these matters that should demand great passion, he's very matter-of-fact. You know what I mean, Vinny? You've seen the same eyes as I have. There's just nothing going on.
I have a poster of John Key, a not-wanted poster of John Key, and it's on my wall. And in fact, there's two of them. Like, so on either side of my wall, there's John Key staring back at me all day long, you know, His eyes follow you wherever you go, and they're dead. You're quite right.
Why would you want to punish yourself like that, Vinny? You know, that's a bit worrying too, mate. I'd take those posters down, I would.
Know thy enemy.
Know thy enemy. Goodness gracious, I think we all know thy enemy a little bit too well by now. We've had enough.
Obviously, we don't know them well enough because we've not beaten them yet.
Well, people talk about all sorts of things. I've heard talk about peaceful revolution. I've heard talk about armed revolution in this country. And I have to say that the easiest way to revolution in this country is come voting day, stick some ticks in the right boxes. Get rid of these has-been parties. One has to consider simply this. Labour and National have had at it now for more than three decades. 30-odd years they've been going flat out at this country with this neoliberal agenda of theirs. It's failed. It's a failed experiment. In terms of how it's impacted on the people, it's a completely failed ideology. Get rid of the darn thing. We don't want it anymore. And people have become upset. They want change. They desperately want change, but they don't really know how to get it. And this is why you get these discussions about, oh, we should have a revolution, and oh, we should do this, and oh, we should do that. No, people need to start giving some thought to voting for something different. Labour and National duopoly, that's what it's been for decades now, a duopoly. We've had National Labour governments all the way through. People need to start thinking about voting another way. Now, NZP, PMP gives people another choice. I would be very grateful if people would have a look at us and decide for themselves whether we're a way to go. But in the end, under MMP, you get two votes. Why not try something new? And if you're that hard about it, well, support your old party if that's what you really must do. MMP allows you to do that.
I remember speaking to Hone Harawira about how much effectiveness is our protesting and even his attempts in Parliament to get important issues sussed. He says, oh, this bugger all chance. And that's the system. That's the system we currently have, and it desperately, desperately needs to be frickin' changed. Hey, anything will do. As long as it's nothing like what we've got now, I think that's about right. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Robbie Clivetti.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
Hey,
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Robbie Clivetti. Is there a website for the PMP?
Well,
I was just thinking about yesterday. I think the Associate Health Minister, Mr. Peter Dunn, the Honourable Honourable Peter Dunn. stood down because he doesn't have 500 people in order to make a party. So legally, he can't stay there in Parliament. And I've been trying to get rid of this guy for oh so many years for habitually being the pin in the government that says, if you want my support in my party, you have to not ever, ever talk about cannabis legalization of any kind. Even though we've had like heaps of commissions on it, and they all said the exact same thing, and now he's gone.
But well, he's a twitching body at the moment, Vinny. Let's put it that way. He's still there, kinda. Peter, what can I say about Peter? What worries me about Peter is he's come out and he said that he's made a few hairy judgments of late. Now, that really bothers me. This guy is, as you say, the linchpin of this government. Here he is. He sits there and he says, well, I've made a few hairy judgments lately. How many of these hairy judgments has he actually made? And on what particularly? I'd love to know.
Probably hairy cannabis buds.
Oh, hairy cannabis buds. You know, the only person I think who has reefer madness in this country is bloody Peter Dunne, honestly. Oops. Sorry about that. Is dear old Peter. He's absolutely maniacal about it. I look at this issue over synthetic cannabis, and it does concern me greatly. It bothers me entirely that these synthetics are on the market. But let's face it, if cannabis was legalised, end of problem. They wouldn't be there. There'd be no market. It's as simple as that.
Who the hell wants an artificial alternative when they can have the real thing and grow it themselves, incidentally?
I think it's well to remember that Peter Dunne is or was also the Minister of Revenue. Synthetics, government's collecting tax on those things, like it or not. That's what they're doing. They just don't like to talk about that very much. And the fact is that there are synthetic companies who produce these synthetics that have said that they're willing to go through these testing stages to get their products into the shops again in a legal form. And Peter has said, go for it. But let's face it, government makes to stand stands to make a buck out of that. There will be a system that licenses those products and government will make a killing. Then at the other end, government will make a killing from GST on those products, because as long as cannabis remains illegal, people will still buy the synthetic product. Make cannabis legal. It's an easy fix. But making cannabis legal is an easy fix in a lot of ways for a lot of things.
If used properly, just cannabis and hemp, you know, with all the medical construction, the biofuels and car paneling, all the kind of 50,000 different products you can do, you could solve nearly every single one of the country's problems, even public ignorance.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, mate. Look, I don't know what the problem is with government's thinking. I can't quite fathom why our two main parties just won't bite the bullet. But I think it comes down to simply this. They've positioned themselves middle ground, and it comes down to simply not having the guts. It would be much easier for a new party to come along and legalise cannabis. Legalise cannabis for medical use, legalise cannabis for personal recreational use, and get into all of these other wonderful initiatives that would benefit this country. You talk about hemp. What have we got? Cannabis produces four times more fibre per acre than a tree does.
And the paper lasts four times as long as well. The Gutenberg Bible was written on hemp paper. It's the reason it's still in such good condition.
Exactly. You know, it just makes sense, Vinny, and I think that's what it actually comes down to. People are asking, why won't Labor do this and why won't National do that? It comes down purely to a question of guts. They have to appeal to the way they've positioned themselves, which is middle ground. But actually, if somebody just took the brave step, that middle ground would see the benefits and come along for the ride eventually.
Well, I do believe it's about guts entirely. But also what's happened now, and this is the reason why I don't like the national elections per se, is because for one voice in one region of the country to spread that voice over the entire nation, it requires extensive broadcasting coverage. It's really the only way to do it, as well as a large fanfare, touring, kissing of babies, and so on and so forth. This whole campaign rigmarole, and I don't like the idea of that whatsoever. Because you've ever had a conversation with somebody, Robbie, and the conversation lasts a minute, and you think to yourself, you know what? I've got lots of people that I have to talk to. I really can't develop a relationship with anybody. under those kind of conditions, except for the people that I'm working with.
I know where you're going. The issue of how our campaigns are run in this country causes us considerable concern. They're becoming more and more kind of Americanized, I guess, where it's the money that counts. Also, New Zealand politics, because we're a very small country, and I understand this perfectly, it's very personality-based. People tend to vote on personality rather than policy in this country. I mean, it's quite a bizarre situation. We can actually have people in this country who can dislike a government incredibly, but they will keep on voting for that party no matter what. There's this kind of blind loyalty system that goes on. And it particularly becomes worse when people actually sign up to a political party and they pay over a fee. At that point, you become a completely mindless follower, basically.
Yeah, I've spoken to many of these people who follow these, and they can't even answer basic questions about their party or the person they're voting for or their policy of any kind, yet they're out there spending hours and hours waving a sign with these people.
Well, exactly that. And if you ask some of the politicians, as I did the other day, a hairy question, they can't answer them either or don't want to.
A sudden case of political amnesia.
Yes. We've got a very forgetful bunch of politicians in this country. They don't seem to remember anything when it comes down to anything important, unfortunately. But that's
what you call somebody who's a child of America and Polynesia, an amnesian.
I'll use that one. Look, mate, there has to be change in this country. That's where it's going. People want that change. They can smell it in the air, but they actually need to have the courage to get out there on voting day and vote for it. Now, there are alternative parties. We're one. I'll mention Mana for a moment. I actually like old Honey. I think Honey's a valuable kind of guy in Parliament because he says the dirty things. And we need people
like white mother fracker.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. But the point is you have to have people who challenge. And Honey is one of those characters. Winston Peters is another one of those kinds of characters. You know, years ago they talked about Winston becoming Prime Minister, and I thought, oh, good Lord, no, please, because the guy is not Prime Minister material. He's very divisive. But that's fine. That's where his talent lies. He can smell an issue, and he can get stuck into it. And I admire Winston for that. So we need
he's like a watchdog, you know. He'd be like a good Minister of Internal Securities or something like that, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Which I think what we'll do, talking about security, is we'll just move on for a bit here, Vinny. I'd like to talk about secrecy in government. I've become pretty convinced. I'm ex-military myself, and I've become pretty convinced over a long period of years that many of the secrets we keep are completely unnecessary. We keep them more because it's boys playing secret squirrel than anything else. There's this perceived need to keep secrets rather than any real requirement to keep them. We talk about conspiracy. Conspiracy finds a very hard place to feel comfortable where there is no secrets. NZPMP has developed a policy now. We'd simply like to get rid of secrecy in government. We don't think it's a necessary thing. I learned a long time ago in my career that the most successful secret service that ever existed in Earth's history was actually the Polish through the Cold War, because they had no secrets. They gave them away to anybody who wanted them. So Poland never actually, through that whole Cold War period, never actually came under any security threat because they simply had no secrets. If you wanted a secret, you could ring up the Polish Secret Service and say, what's going on in Botswana? I'd be very happy to tell you, thank you. It was as simple as that. these secrets are so bizarrely unnecessary, and it creates a whole new industry, the secrets industry. We've got two new industries in New Zealand and globally, actually. We've got the ever-growing security services that apparently look after us for every tiny little thing. They save us from these invented foes that exist all over the planet. And apparently it has to be Al-Qaeda, it has to be. It just has to be them. No matter what happens, it has to be them. Al-Qaeda, in fact, they're an invention. There is or has never actually been an organised Al-Qaeda organisation. It just simply never existed until George W. came along and created the darn thing for us so that we had an enemy we could fight. And they did fight them poor sods. They fought these poor sods in Afghanistan, and they fought these poor sods in Iraq. But they were just, on the whole, pretty ordinary folk. I know what sort of attitude I would take here if I'm living here in New Zealand. If some invading force came to this country, they could expect some problems from me. And it's those. Same perceptions that you have in these other countries. These security services, it's a brand new industry, and they only exist to protect us from these invented foes. We've got, even here in New Zealand, we see examples of this. We've got the Aviation Security Service, which on the whole, they do a good job for what they do. But basically, I'm not meaning to be mean to the guys. They're fairly unnecessary. We would really love to get rid of secrecy in government. We don't think that, apart from ongoing operational matters, we don't think there's much need to keep secrets at all. And we think that the government secret files should be opened for public scrutiny. If they're over 5 years old, that's it. Open the books. I'm picking, though, Vinnie, if that we were successful in getting into government, we'd find some awfully horrid secrets in those books, I truly do. And I think we would have to start looking at matters of criminal culpability, actually. And I think that's also a reason why we keep secrets, is because certain people don't want certain things to come to light. Because if they did, they've got a problem.
Secrecy is very valuable in order to conceal your scumbaggery.
Well, that's about where it is. Look, there are issues over some of the business dealings of John Key. They definitely beg the question, what's been going on here, John? What have you really been up to? There's questions over John Banks and what he's been up to. We know that John Banks has had shares in various companies, this whole debacle over teachers' pays and goodness knows what. John Banks is in it up to his neck, but these things are cleverly hidden. Well, not so cleverly hidden at times, but nevertheless, they are hidden. I think we could, if we were to really put John Banks under scrutiny, I think he could find himself in a lot of bother. I think a lot of politicians could find themselves in a lot of bother over different things they've done. Certainly, over my in my service, there were secrets that I came across that astounded me. Truly, they astounded me. We had situations here in New Zealand where our services have basically committed acts of mutiny against our people and our government, and they've gotten away with it.
Yeah, I think this is the long, sad lesson of history, is that people come in because and they seize power because ordinary, good, decent people don't really want power and control over other people. You ever notice that? They want other people to get on with their lives. But some people don't like that idea and would prefer to control your lives for you. And they wind up going into the power positions. Straightforward. We'll be right back after the break.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen. I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Welcome back.
I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest is Robbie Kaiviti, and we've got him for one more segment before we bring on another guest from New Zealand, incidentally talking about racial issues in New Zealand. And we mentioned biculturalism before. Did you know that English is not even an official language of New Zealand?
Well, I didn't actually know that, Vinnie, to be quite honest, but that's kind of bizarre, isn't it?
We have two official languages, Māori and Sign Language, and English is not on that list as one of the official languages. What?
Yeah, strange. Look. One of the things I love most about living in New Zealand, and truly it just gets me every time, I can walk down Queen Street, mate, and in the course of an hour, I can meet people from every corner of the globe, every religion and every political persuasion. And I think that's one of the most wonderful things, one of the most wonderful features of this country. That diversity enriches us, absolutely enriches us. And why we can't embrace that more than we have, I'm a little bit confused, because I come from a multicultural background myself.
Maybe the problem with diversity is that it's very difficult to unite people against a common enemy.
Well, I think people do unite around nationhood. I don't particularly want to talk about the Israelis, but if we look at Israel, it is a multicultural country, and it is certainly a country that has united around nationhood. This is a country with people coming from all sorts of places, and they've managed to do that. Unfortunately, they've got some other problems, which I don't want to get into. But, I think there's lots of examples around the world of multicultural countries managing to unite. I think a very bad example of a multicultural nation is UK. I think they failed dismally in managing to bring together their people under that sort of one nation kind of concept. They've got some shocking problems over there. And I feel sad for the country, because it's all going to blow up in a rather unpleasant sort of way.
I heard a statistic out of the Daily Mail, I think, or it might have been the Telegraph. There's certain schools in London where 8 out of 10 children, English is their second language.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I was in Britain a while back, and I was amazed walking through one or two schools that all the signage in the school was in everything but English. There was Arabic was the preferred language for signage in one of the schools that I went to, and I thought it was kind of bizarre. I was waiting for a bus in Piccadilly Circus, and I didn't realise that you had to have the right change to get on the bus. And this rather lovely old London girl came up to me and said, "You know, you got to have the right money, son, you know." And she launched into this incredible tirade about how she felt that she was a stranger in her own land. And then she looked at me smiling. She pressed a few coins into my hand, the dear old thing, and said, "Oh, it's lovely to meet somebody like you who's not a foreigner, you know?" And I said, "I come from New Zealand, dear, you know? I'm a colonial." And she said, "Oh, you know what I mean." Well, to some degree, this kind of impressed on me all of the problems that that Britain has, and I came away from that very small experience, and I said to my partner at the time, I said, "Britain's in for a lot of trouble. It's going to happen." And sure as darn, that's exactly where Britain's going at the moment. They've got some awful problems, and I don't know how they're going to work them out. But in terms of this,
throughout history, I think mass migrations of foreign cultures into other countries has always resulted in a massive wave of racism and infighting in those countries. And I think this is being done deliberately so that everybody's fighting with each other instead of fighting the beast that serves the same master.
You don't think that humans are just naturally racist, to be quite honest?
We actually are. We tend to stick with our own racial groups, and those ones that have a monoculture, countries around the world have virtually no racism, because when you see a foreigner, it's like, oh, as a foreigner, you know, it's kind of like novel. It's when it's this, I don't know what the proportion is or whatever, but ignorance starts to spread as soon as fear of the outsider sets in. It's unavoidable.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the old propaganda machine starts to work, doesn't it? People dislike differences in others. And people go about this process of creating a false propaganda that they present to others. And you know, the world is fundamentally mindless. I read a statistic a while back that kind of really bothered me, actually, that the average IQ of the planet is 78. You know, that's next to being a vegetable, to be quite honest. There just seems to be this mindlessness. Basically, you can, so long as you have some sort of authority behind you, you can basically tell the people anything. And government uses this technique devastatingly. They're engaged in this kind of propaganda war against our most disadvantaged and disenfranchised in this country. You know, they've told us that the problem with this country is the unemployed. The problem with this country is the solo parents. The problem with this country is damned old folks, you know? They've actually started to try and tell us now that the problem with New Zealand is our pensioners. We don't have enough money for our pensioners. New Zealand is in a wonderful position. We're a very small country, Vinny, and that actually advantages us. We need to get away from this growth at any cost kind of mentality that we have. There is great advantages in being a small country. What we actually need to do, if you want to look at the issue of pensions, is we need to actually ask New Zealanders to have more children, because if you want to pay for old age pensions, you need a younger crop of people coming along who are going to eventually go into the workforce and facilitate that. So we actually need to be, to put it very bluntly, we need to be asking New Zealanders to breed. But now here's the trick. If you're going to do that, you have to put families in a position where one person out of that couple can actually stay at home and do some child raising. If you look at our youth problems in this country, it comes down to, you know, it seems very complex, but actually the answers are quite simple. We have a lot of youth problems in this country, but what it really comes down to is simply this: there's nobody at home. We've got a system now that requires that a couple, well, both of them have to be working. You've got to be working to make your way in this life, because you need all these things, apparently. But what this country actually needs is good, solid families. And the way to get good, solid families, I don't want to say to go back to a kind of a traditional model, but in some ways we actually do. We have to put families in a position where when you do a fair day's work, you get a fair day's pay, and that enables you to look after your family in a reasonable sort of a lifestyle, a reasonable sort of lifestyle. And one parent needs to be at home. I don't care who that parent is. I don't care whether it's the guy or whether it's the lady of the family. I really don't give a darn. That's entirely up to them. But we've got to get back to a situation where people earn enough to simply be able to look after their families in a reasonable manner, and that they are able to have that parental supervisory kind of role over their children.
Well, I completely agree with you, and I was just thinking about this. You know how you get a maternity leave, like this statutory amounts that the companies have to pay to a woman when she's pregnant, so that she can have like a 6 months to get over the pregnancy and take the child through its immediate infancy. You know, maybe you could extend that for other people as well for up to 5 years. I don't know, but that's just putting more rules and regulations. It'd just be much simpler if people were paid more, taxed less, so that they could actually afford to buy a home and take care of their freaking families in it and feed them.
That's exactly right. There's this rhetoric around, you know, higher wages, this will take care of all our problems. But actually, higher wages don't take care of our problems at all. Every time people get pay rises across the board, inevitably what happens is inflation goes up, the cost of living goes up. So you end up, if you look historically, you actually end up slightly worse off. Every time you get a pay increase across the board in this country, you tend to actually end up historically worse off. So pay rises is not the answer. That has to be done in conjunction with something else. We have to drive down the cost of living.
Indeed. Well, Robbie, we don't have enough time to get into all of these sorts of issues with you. I'm sure we could talk all day. And thank you very much for coming on the show with me, mate.
Thank you, Vinny. It's been very enjoyable, and I'll catch up with you for a drink sometime, I think.
All right. Cheers, mate. Some description of Glen Eden Pub, I guess.
Oh, I guess. You have a great day, mate.
You, mate. Cheers.
Thanks, finally. Bye now.
All right. And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the commercial break, and we'll be bringing on a lovely man by the name of Joe Trindle, who also incidentally was in the military, and we are going to be talking about New Zealand's bicultural sort of treaty kind of prospectimic things. I'm not 100% sure, but we'll find out, won't we? Back in a minute. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy because now everybody gets a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Joe Trinder. Joe, welcome to the program.
Oh, kia ora, Vinny. How are you?
Well, you're somewhat fabulous is my standard remark. go ahead.
I'm here today to talk to you about John Ansell as a right of response. My name's Joe Trinder. I'm the editor of AotearoaGovt.com. It's a Māori website, Māori sovereignty movement. And what I want to do today is talk about the entrenched treaty hate movement. Now, Vinny, what's the Treaty of Waitangi to you?
Agreement between two peoples getting British subjectiveness, you know, they become subjects of the Crown. And all the benefits that go with it, like a legal system, military defence. If you come under attack, the Empire will come in and sweep in and protect you, allegedly. Didn't work very well in World War II when they destroyed Singapore. But that's basically it. Just two people living together in mutual peace and harmony with frickin' respect.
Yeah, that's a pretty good description of it. Well, way I think of it is, that in 1840, if you were to look at the world in 1840, Britain at that time was at war with China over the Opium Wars. China did two-thirds of Great Britain's economy. And so what they were looking at is across the planet, the British diaspora had colonised vast sections of the planet from North America, Australia to Africa. And what they wanted to do this one time was get enlightened colonisation. And they thought that they could, the British Colonial Office honestly thought that it could get it right this one time, enlightened colonisation. So what they did is they sent Captain William Hobson of the Royal Navy out to New Zealand to sign a treaty between the Her Majesty Queen Victoria and the United Tribes of New Zealand. So that's what I think of our New Zealand's founding national document. It's fantastic. It's enlightened colonisation. And as Vinny, as you said, I agree with you. It is about two peoples caring for each other, as also the Race Relations Commissioner Susan Devoy described it. And I agree with her on that. Mm. Yeah.
I've always seen the thing that I get most about race relations is what Dame Fiona Cooper said. Marry each other. You got problems with somebody else's race? Sort it out in the bedroom. And sure enough, everybody's been intermarrying all over the country. So it's like there's nothing pure about our race anymore. There's really not that much of a percentile that differentiates race in this country anymore. We're all a bunch of mongrels, aren't we?
Yeah, well, that's right, yeah. Well, what John Ancillers and his group Treaty Gate, what I like to call them are treaty haters, or because what they do is they hate New Zealand's founding national document, the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, for all the American listeners out there, if you were to know of anyone that hated your founding national document, the Declaration of Independence, you'd probably call them un-American, you'd probably call them a terrorist. You wouldn't think of them very highly as American citizens. Well, here in New Zealand, the roles are entirely reversed. If you hate and despise your founding national document, you're someone to be looked up to, you're someone who could run as prime minister, like Don Brash, you're someone that society respects. So here in New Zealand, we've got the roles entirely reversed. We don't enjoy or like or our history or our founding national document. And I think that what we need to do is start to really acknowledge it. Yeah.
So why do they hate the treaty exactly? What is it that John Ansell said that he hates about the treaty itself?
Well, what John is saying is he thinks that there is an alternative treaty called the Littlewood Paper. Now, the Littlewood Paper, what it says in the Littlewood Paper is to all New Zealanders. So it's vastly different from the original Treaty of Waitangi. What the original Treaty of Waitangi says, and I'll quote it, to the respective families and individuals thereof the full, exclusive and undisturbed possession of their lands and estates, forest, fisheries and other properties. So this is absolutely everything between heaven and earth. You name it. This is wind, this is sun resource, this is the foreshore. It's that really does mean everything that you will see a Māori activist complaining about on Waitangi Day. They're not having people on. It really does say that. This is what their ancestors really signed up to.
So, and that was the Littlewood Treaty.
No, what the Littlewood Treaty says is it's vastly different. The Littlewood Paper, it says to all New Zealanders. So instead of saying that it's to the respective families and individuals in the United Tribes, it says it's to all New Zealanders. So basically what the Littlewood Paper is saying is to any man and his dog that comes to New Zealand, whether he's from Syria, Afghanistan, he now owns all the lands of New Zealand. So what's really wrong with the Littlewood paper is, why would 530 chiefs sign up to a treaty that offered their lands to anyone that turned up to New Zealand? It's illogical.
Perhaps they were fearful of threats by rival tribes taking their land, enslaving their people, perhaps, and wanted protection of the British Empire?
I think it was more around trade, to be honest.
United Tribes had the United Tribes before the treaty actually been flying the United Tribes flag and engaging in trade, or was that afterwards?
What happened is they had their own Declaration of Independence in 1835, and what they did is they declared to the British Colonial Office that they were a sovereign nation. So this is 5 years before signing the Treaty of Waitangi. So what happened in return is King George gave them their own coat of arms, or their own flag, white ensign, that you often see Māori flying today. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I was just thinking about this too, is in terms of Māori hapus, tribal areas and things of that nature, what would a Māori system of government look like differently, I mean, in terms of Māori sovereignty?
Well, I think it would be a lot more left-orientated than right-orientated like the New Zealand government. It would probably lean closer to socialism, as a lot of Māori politicians brought in socialism, although you do see a lot of Māori conservative MPs like Winston Peters, Hekia Parata. So it could even have a broad spectrum. It could be no different from what the New Zealand government is if there was a Māori sovereignty movement. But I don't think so. It's going to be happening in the near future. There's no calls for Māori to self-govern themselves at the moment, or what they call tino ranga tira tangata. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Vinny.
Oh, well, I was just wondering as well, in terms of the treaty grievance process, how much money has been obtained by the New Zealand government and given to Māori since the treaty grievance panels and so on and so forth started? And how much of that money filtered down to the poorest of Māori who need it the most?
Okay, that's a really good question. And what I'll do is I'll actually break it down into the numbers. So the Waitangi Tribunal was started in 1975 by Matthew Rachu, and what it was designed to do was compensate Māori, not for the Treaty of Waitangi, but really for the New Zealand Settlements Act 1863. Now, what the New Zealand Settlements Act did is it confiscated 3 million acres of private land. Now, as you heard me say before, in the Treaty of Waitangi, that it says undisturbed estates. Well, what this did, it was inconsistent with the Treaty of Waitangi, and what it did is it confiscated 3 million acres of land. Now, what John will tell you about the New Zealand Settlements Act, it was against tribes that rebelled. Well, that's so far from the truth, it's not funny. What really happened is it confiscated from tribes that were fighting for the British government. These were people that were in the New Zealand Armed Forces, the Armed Constabulary. And so it took land from them. It took land from iwi and tribes that were doing nothing. They were just sitting there. So it was just a policy that was, it broke a whole lot of British laws as well. What it did is it broke the Constitutions Act. Under the Constitutions Act, it says the state may not procure private land. Now, in the Treaty of Waitangi, it says that Māori are British subjects, so therefore we're protected by British laws. Secondly, what it did is it broke the Magna Carta, and that's a right to representation. So you should be allowed to go to court. If the state's going to take your land, you should be allowed to go to court. And also, in the first to fourth parliament, when these were being when the New Zealand Settlements Act was being decided upon, there were no Māori in Parliament. It wasn't one in Parliament, yet Māori were 80% of the population, and there were 70 British colonial MPs in Parliament. So it's kind of not fair. So to get 2% value of the confiscated estates today is, John's winning. He can't see. Chris Finlayson is doing him a favour because these are full and final treaty settlements. Once these are finished, and it probably is only going to go up to $2 billion, then it's full and final. That's it for all iwi.
So, and again, $2 billion, how much of that gets to Porta Māori who need it?
Okay. This is a really interesting question that a lot of British New Zealanders ask. And first off, that it's not the business of iwi to give welfare to their members. And because first off, they've only got hundreds of millions of dollars to do it with. It's not a lot of money if you're wanting to hand out money. And also, handing out welfare does not create income. So what they
well, they
what
could
they
build
to do,
schools, marae, have food, community gardens, things of that nature. You know, there's all sorts of different cultural and resourceful things that have benefited Māori throughout the ages.
Yeah. Well, if you were to think of it of a business perspective, imagine you were given $170 million. Now, if you handed it out to all the people, then all that money would disappear. What they have to do is they've got to invest it in business like Naitahu. Naitahu owns a lot of the tourist business throughout the South Island. Now, what happens is that brings back recurring revenue. It's pointless giving out money if you're not creating recurring revenue. So once you create that recurring revenue, then what you do is you create scholarships and then you hand out scholarships. It's better to teach a man to fish than to, you know. So that's how they're doing it, is building up their base revenue. So take Naitahu, for instance. They got $170 million for the entire South Island, which is the size of Wales and England combined in landmass, and they've turned that into probably around about $5 billion. I don't know the numbers, but I know it's in the billions, and it's a lot of money. To turn $170 million into $5 billion, that's creating more revenue, and then now they're starting to get those base welfare initiatives in place. Like they've got scholarships, they've got sports initiatives for kids where they'll after school they'll go down in like Invercargill and they'll play sports and they'll have a sports trainer. So those things do come eventually. But if you're only getting hundreds of millions of dollars, there's not a lot you can do with it until you've turned it into billions.
Well, it depends whether or not you're paying people to do it or whether you're using the money as a resource and asking community groups to volunteer their time and effort in order to make the programs work. A voluntaristic kind of society, bringing the community together and communities that are involved in certain projects and things like that tend to be a lot more well off. Less people go hungry, less people get depressed and less suicides, you know, the whole works.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah,
and this is also another thing that that really disturbs me as well is the defathering of families just in general. I think has hit Māori particularly hard, and I think it's like when you're a young boy and you haven't had your dad there for all or most of your life, you're seven times more likely to get a criminal conviction. And now, nearly what half one elder I said to is more along the lines of 80%. Of prisoners in New Zealand are Māori. You're like nine times more likely to be convicted of the same thing that a white person would do and sent to prison for it. You know, I think there's parts of the system that are actually, in my opinion, deliberately practicing eugenics on Māori and trying to destroy them. And this whole treaty thing might be one part of it. Because you think about the profits, only hundreds of millions of dollars and stuff like that. It's not a hell of a lot to share around. So I think maybe it's not being shared around. And certain Māori are getting maybe more than their fair share, perhaps. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Joe Trinder is my guest.
I wake up just to go back to sleep. I act real shallow, but I'm in too deep. I know I care about insects and violence. And every baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I gotta get a grip, but unless I let you give me the slip.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because the world's so full of chaos and madness and various other forms of scumbag. If you lose your sense of humour, you go fucking nuts. And this is something I've also noticed just recently. I mentioned this on the show before for those who are avid listeners. Fluoride has just been taken out of the water supply in Hamilton. And you would not believe the debate that has been stimulated against this by moronic, incapable of researching or listening, mindless, brainwashed sheep who think that an ad hominem attack by calling you a retard or a conspiracy theorist is a valid scientific argument why fluoride is good for you. I've heard it repeated to me thousands of times. It must be true. Really? Why do you think they had to repeat it to you 1,000 times if it's so frickin' true, mate? All right. Joe Trinder is my guest. Now, we had to relay this because I appreciate, and Joe reminded me of this over the break, and it was actually quite spot on, really, that Americans in general don't even know what a Māori is. Would you give us a brief explanation of what a Māori actually is?
Okay. The Māori people are actually originally East Polynesians. The Polynesian people colonized from an area, probably Tonga, Samoa, all the way over to the East Islands. They colonized a part of the earth about the size of Russia down to New Zealand. And they were also 500 years before Columbus, they discovered North America and via Hawaii. And so there's been chicken bones found in South America that are pre-Columbian. So they explored the entire Pacific Ocean. And evidence of that is that they brought the kumara, or the sweet potato, back from South America, back over to New Zealand. And it was a staple diet of Māori when they arrived here at around about 1280 to 1350 AD. And so they were the first people here in New Zealand, despite some amateur historians disagreeing with that. And they can be seen in Hollywood on, the Hangover Part 2 with the tattoo that Mike Tyson's got, that's Māori. There's a new movie coming out called Ender's Game, where Sir Ben Kingsley will be playing a Māori character in there, a military Māori character. Once Were Warriors is a movie that shows Māori post-colonisation and the effects of colonisation on Māori. So we're well represented in Hollywood.
Robbie Williams, the big pop star, he's got a big Māori tattoo on his arm.
Yeah, that's right. And Russell Crowe is Māori. He is off Gladiator. He is on the Māori electoral roll. Māori is becoming not part of just New Zealand culture, it's becoming part of world culture globally. People are starting to be attracted towards it. And you'll notice it in the All Black haka, which is famous for the All Blacks. And that's a professional team that's won more than any other professional sports team in history. So, yeah, that's who the Māori people are. Yeah.
Now, we're getting into treaties and all of this kind of stuff. Now, like I said, the eugenics agenda, it's not just being played on Māori, mind you. It's hitting Māori particularly hard, though. And some And some believe that there's a genetic predisposition through through traditional diet and so on and so forth. What's happening to Māori with the introduction of all these processed foods and things like that, obesity levels are going well out of control. Smoking, well out of control. Single, solo parents, well out of control. People going to prison, well out of control. I don't think the Māori people orchestrated all of that coincidentally on themselves.
Well, what was interesting in your last interview with John Ansell was, and the first off, where how he starts off is, Māori are privileged and they live in entitlement. Then around about 10 minutes later, he just announced all the stats that that you've just mentioned, highest unemployment, highest prison rates, highest on welfare. Well, I always perceived that if you were unemployed in prison, is not somewhere you would really find privilege. You maybe find things like maybe gang rape or getting shivved, or, but it's not really in the same ballpark as privilege. And with all those statistics that you've just mentioned, I think there is that falls squarely on colonization. I think that Māori haven't managed to adapt as quick as they could to colonization, and it does take a terrible effect on every single civilization that has been colonized across the world, from Australian Aborigines, North American Indians, Iroquois, Cherokee, you name it. Wherever a civilization has been colonized, it's been it's been a mitigated disaster, to be honest.
Oh, South American cultures is fracking decimated by the Spanish, annihilated. You know, this is the true story of colonization. You know, all around the world, dig this. You ever met somebody and you know that they're a really bad person, they've got no empathy whatsoever, you know, they're the classic quintessential psychopath that will smile at you and treat you like one of the family until the day it comes to knife you in the spine? There's that kind of person running around the whole world, heating it up and just trying to take it all over. And it doesn't matter who the hell stands in their way. Anybody who's got it like, hey, we've got a nice, decent culture. We treat each other with respect and with families and stuff like that. Well, good. You won't resist me when I shoot you. You know, this kind of mentality. And, you know, colonization, heck, we're living in a global empire. All right. You can't have an empire without colonies. And now the corporations own everything, including the government.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
So how is this debate fitting in with that paradigm for you?
Well, with colonization, you mean? Like, how is it
with the global empire in place and the corporations owning everything, including the government? How does Māori sovereignty fit into that?
Well, if you look at like iwi corporations, they started in 1990. They got the first injection into the New Zealand economy. So the first treaty settlement started for Māori. Before then, they've basically been excluded from the New Zealand economy. They couldn't get bank loans. So they've started. And now they started with $1 billion. Well, the Māori economy is almost, in 20 years, gone up to $35 billion. And this is just through investment, wise management of that $1 billion. Now, the New Zealand Stock Exchange, which is several hundred years old, it started in the 1800s, and it's a mixture of all exchanges from around the country, it is valued at $45 billion. So Māori, now that they've got a chance in the economy, are starting to catch up. Probably by about 2030, they will pass the New Zealand Stock Exchange.
And may I ask as well, considering that, there's the, you know, you can't throw money at a problem, can you? Social problems are caused by social causes, aren't they? And what I've found, and this is across the board, doesn't matter what race you are, handing out welfare really of any kind, as we mentioned before, you know, teaching a man to fish, actually really destroys people. It makes them depressed, unmotivated, and they keep finding ways to rot the system. You know, I have several cousins up north that are exactly this way inclined, you know, trying to tell me what different lies that I can tell so I can get extra benefits out of the government and things like this. I was just wondering, does this mentality exist, where the hand that feeds you is also the hand that holds you down and does so deliberately?
Yeah, well, I understand what you mean. Welfare is absolutely devastating for people. It doesn't help them really in the long term. But there is a cause why people are actually there on welfare. And I can relate it back to the New Zealand Settlements Act 1863. If those people had their land not be taken off them and then they were sort of pushed into state housing, today they would be the land gentry. Their parents would have been able to afford university educations for them, and they wouldn't be at the bottom of the food chain in New Zealand. So if you look at New Zealand, it's a cappuccino economy. The Polynesian and Māori people, they're at the bottom of the food chain, and they're suffering on a daily basis. Like, if we're to talk about privilege, I at the moment, I live in state housing area in Mangere in South Auckland. Yesterday I saw a British man scavenging through the rubbish and getting out food out of a rubbish bin, and he wasn't Māori or Polynesian. This is an area of poverty. Where John lives, he lives down in the waterfront in Wellington. It's quite a wealthy area. And so if you were to look at New Zealand, at a map of New Zealand, where the Māori Polynesian people live, we live in the poor areas, and British New Zealanders, they don't live in the same areas as us. It's like they all left or something.
I'm also really concerned about the term British New Zealanders. I mean, what does that mean? I mean... If you weren't born in Britain, didn't spend any time there, are you a British New Zealander?
Well, I'll be honest with you.
Are you just a New Zealander?
I'll be honest with you, Vinny. I've asked Anglo New Zealanders, Pākehā, or British New Zealanders what they want to call themselves, and We try and ask them delicately. I asked about 20 of them, what do you want to be called? I mean, you aren't Māori, and we have to have a name for yous, and we invented the name Pākehā, and yous don't agree with the word Pākehā, so what do yous want to be called?
Have you ever been at a party where you got somebody in front of you recognise, but you don't remember their name? You know what you do? You use pronouns, you know, names that stand instead of a noun, like bro, dude, or cuz, man.
yeah, that's right. Or mate.
Yeah, that's right. What do we call you people? Well, just call me mate, you know, bro. Dude, whatever. and there's also this other question I have as well, is personal national identity. And what happens when a country doesn't really have a cohesive national identity, that there is in fact a separate identification, like we've got one New Zealand general role and we've got one Māori role? And I wonder what the effect is of social cohesion there. Is if do Māori feel separate from the New Zealand government, separate from all the other people that live here?
Well, that's a good subject, Vinny. What happened in history about 146 years ago was Māori weren't allowed on the general electoral roll if they had tribal lands. So if they wanted to add those lands into being private lands into the economy and then get bank loans on them or try and develop the land into a farm, what they had to do is they had to go to the native land courts. And if you didn't do that, you weren't allowed on the general roll. So what it was actually racist democracy, that if you had private land and you didn't want to enter it into the economy for sale, then you remained on the Māori electoral roll. Now, there were four Māori seats started up, And these were held by people that were Kupapa chiefs. They were fighting as officers for the New Zealand government and the armed forces and the armed constabulary. They didn't choose people who we wanted. They chose who people who they wanted. Now, there were 70 MPs in Parliament, and Māori made up probably 70-80% of the population. So democracy was not really working out. Now, 146 years later, we're still with these Māori seats, and they're still a minority seat, and they haven't been turned off or anything like that. There's political parties out there that want to stop them. But, you know, these were forced on us, and now that we're starting to, Māori are starting to use them to their advantage with MPs like Hone Harawira, like your last caller you had, and he's starting to say the things people don't want to hear, but they've got to be said. Well, that's just the way of democracy. In fact, how a democracy should really work is we should all have race-based seats. Why not? Could you not have sit for the Pākehā seat of West Auckland? Why can't there be the Asian seat of Howick? And so why can't we turn a democracy around into racial-based seats? And so everyone's...
Yeah. And so everybody's cohesive. Right. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break. We seem to be having a little bit of technical difficulties here. It matters not. Okay. Well, anyway, seeing as we're probably doing this with a little bit of dead air in the background, sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. And a little bit of issues. Anyway, turning about making a more cohesive society, and I think this is actually the very point, is do you make a society more one by separating out everybody's representation of their own particular social groups and their own particular interests, or do you broad brushstroke and say everybody has the same basic needs and same basic interests?
Well,
food, shelter, water, clean air, energy, freedom, the ability to operate your own businesses, the ability to support a family with decent wages and things of this nature. These are very universal principles. Incidentally, if all of these things were paid attention to, it would appear that the problems in society, and particularly those problems that seem to have hit Māori particularly hard, would become solved, because they're universal and they wouldn't be left behind with the rest of it. Unless, of course, it's racially motivated. And I see a lot of racial profile going on, particularly by the New Zealand police. And they're always busting people for... basically, if you're Māori, you're walking down the street, you've got a tinny in your pocket, you're wearing a hoodie, and you've got a starter cap on or something like that. Hey, you get stopped. But if you're driving a Porsche, wearing a slick suit, you've got a gram of cocaine in your pocket, oh, come on through, sir. Selective profiling, enforcement, and much higher conviction rates. So this is what happens, I think, when you start thinking about people based on race instead of just treating them as a human being, part of the human race. How do you feel about that, man?
Well, let's take a look at what's been happening in New Zealand news recently. And if you've been keeping a track on the news in New Zealand, there's been actually quite a lot of discrimination going on towards Māori and Pacific Islanders just recently. And it's happening now on a weekly basis. Like, even Asians are affected as well, Asian New Zealanders. I'll show you this cartoon that was in the Marlborough Express. Now, if you put in racist cartoon in Google, you'll find out about it. Now, what the cartoon portrays is it portrays...
What does it say? What's the speech bubble? Could you read it out? I couldn't make it.
If we can get away with this, the more cash left for booze, smokes, and pokies. So what's happened in New Zealand...
And what it's got, just for the radio listeners, it's got a... a image of some giant obese Maori jogging along with these little white kids around them, and then just talking about getting more booze, smokes, and stuff, and pokies, the gambling, and all of this sort of stuff. Right? Is that what I?
Yeah. So that's absolutely correct. So what it's working off stereotypes that Maori people are and Polynesian are obese, they gamble, they smoke. And honestly, it's not true. I don't smoke. I don't drink a lot anymore. I went to Las Vegas, spent a week there. I didn't gamble once. So they're working off stereotypes. And so these are discriminatory media articles that are in the New Zealand press all the time, and they hit the entire world. The whole world finds out about these. Like recently we had a MP called Richard Prosser, and he made a comment about men from the Middle East are from Wagistan. We had a young lady.
Are you sure his name was Richard Prosser or something that rhymes with Prosser?
Something that rhymes with Prosser. recently, Air New Zealand rejected a girl who was trying to become an air hostess steward at Air New Zealand. Now, what she had is what people would call a tā moko, and Māori say a tā moko is different from a tattoo. It's what it is. It's sort of a koru design on her arm. Now, what their excuse was, Air New Zealand, this is a classic, they have aircraft and their liveries have got koru designs on them, all painted all over them, ferns and everything. Now, what their excuse was a customer would get on that plane that's covered in koru designs and then see the same koru design on this girl's arm and get frightened. And I was just thinking, where's the common sense here? Is common sense not common to everyone?
Like,
yeah,
it's like they're afraid. I mean, think about this, right? If a teacher gets sent into a school full of kids or something like that, and they've been working with kids for years, and suddenly one kid comes up to them and wants to learn something, and then they get freaked out by it. And they've been doing it for years. It's ridiculous.
I mean, hello, we're in the South Pacific. This is where tattoo was invented, and. Recently, we had a Dutch diplomat come out to our naval base, HMNZS Fillmore, and she made some really nasty comments about what we call a porphyry. It's a greeting, a Māori greeting, and what happened because she made these comments? What she said was. It was grotesque and it was lewd and along those sort of lines. Well, what happened is a lot of New Zealanders agreed with her. And that really hurts, you know, when your fellow countrymen, you know, they're agreeing with someone who's criticising their own countrymen. So where's the patriotism, guys? Seriously. I mean, what other greeting are we going to give dictatorial? Do we get out the bagpipes like the Scottish? Do we do Morris dancing? I mean, if there's something else we can bring to the fore, let's bring it. But until then, it's going to have to be porphyries. Yeah. What's your opinion?
Of people being welcomed in a traditional way with the Māori wailing and the dancing and the protruding of the tongues and the jabbing of spears into the air and the hopping around and the grass skirts and the full body tattoos and all of that kind of stuff. I think it's freaking awesome.
Oh, you're funny.
I mean, well, dig this. You know how badly communication and welcoming is turned into? Once upon a time, a guy would come to a person and he would actually take off his frickin' hat and say, good afternoon, good sir, how goes the morrow? This has been shortened over time to sup.
um, one other comment that Marie Krupp made was she says she felt sorry for the Pākehā officers that had to stand and endure the porphyry. Well, I was also in the Navy as well, and she never thought to think that the men doing the porphyry were also naval officers as well. In fact, 50% of the armed forces is Māori. They are the men who are down the domestics on our warships or in the barracks in our army bases. So, you know, Māori do contribute to this country and they do try hard. There's just some that haven't coped with colonisation so well. And, you know, as
a country, they're just not coping with slavery very well. You know what's happening, bro? This is exactly the same thing that's been happening to African Americans in America. Exactly the same thing, isn't it? Society been broken down. They put liquor shops and gun stores on the same street corners and stuff like that, and they just inject all this stuff. 80 million black babies aborted, the biggest genocide in the 20th century. You know, and nobody's talking about that kind of thing. Exact same situation, isn't it? People don't like to deal with slavery, and it destroys their communities.
Yeah, well, one comparison I can make to of Mangere to some of the suburbs in Los Angeles is we don't have the gun stores, but we've got the fried chicken stores and we've got the liquor stores, and they're here in abundance here in South Auckland.
I have an amazing anecdote. I was down Otahuhu. Right close, that's pretty close to Mangere, isn't it? And my friend had actually done his own personal survey. He likes a bit of gin and tonic, and he's trying to survey, you know, like the whole city pretty much in every single suburb, the liquor stores and the average price of it. He says the cheapest liquor in the country is South Auckland.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually quite cheap.
It's not a coincidence.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's quite cheap to live out here, like if you go to the flea markets on a Saturday morning. So they do have a lot of sort of very cheap things here in Auckland, in South Auckland, yeah.
Now, speaking of society's woes, we've got about maybe 5 minutes plus left in the broadcast. And I wanted to say something about John Ansell. He is in a bad state right now. He didn't have as many people turn up to a meeting as he'd hoped. Another party, One Law for All, was set up, and they didn't even invite him to the creative meeting to set it up. And it was basically his idea. He's been sidelined by a lot of quote unquote friends. He's had a death in the family. Right at this particular point in time, and that's the reason why he's actually not on here today for a debate, is because he's feeling really, really down. And I said to him, in those situations, and I've walked the line, I've suffered everything you can imagine, just well, not everything you can imagine, but I said to him, look, bro, you just need to drink more and take a couple of weeks off, you know, recharge the batteries. Because some of the stuff, it really does get on top of you, especially when things are crumbling to Shiite Muslim around you. But yeah, I just wanted to get that out there.
Oh, I'd like to say to John, I'm sorry that's all happened to you at this stage, and I honestly do hope that you that things do improve for you, and that you do get back into it, because even though I fundamentally disagree with your views on colonization as a gift for Māori, what I do appreciate is that you've brought it to the fore. And had it not been for John, I wouldn't have gotten into investigating what this was all about. So, you know, he is getting at a point, and and Māori I don't think so collectively. I don't think so. We hate him. And I was really disappointed how he was treated at Waitangi and also on Radio Live. But, John, if you're out there and you're listening, I'd really like to have a proper debate with you, even on the show, or and so.
Well, you know what? Let's not even call it a debate, a discussion, because that's how we do it here on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We just, you know, we've just been sitting there having a laugh and talking about a few important things, isn't it? You know, that's the style that I like to put across. You know, there's nothing official about this this show, really, is there? I think that's the reason why society is so misinformed and dumbed down in the first place, is because people aren't willing to just sit back and listen to each other speak and try to understand where they're coming from.
Well, we really appreciate if John would come out and just have a discussion with us and we, it's a great subject to chill out. It's interesting. It's New Zealand history. It's fascinating, and he's on to something. Which
he's generated more public interest in this subject than anybody in living memory that I can think of.
Well, that's right. If you know, I was talking to Morgan Godfrey, who we had a speak with, a debate on Close Up on TVNZ. And that was the highest rating show that that Close Up have ever had. So it's a subject that's very dear to all New Zealanders, of Māori, European, Asian, all of us. Yeah.
And what I find very interesting is that because there's such intense interest there, it means that there's probably extremes to both sides, you know, like there'd be racist white New Zealanders, and there'd also, do you reckon there's such a thing as a racist Māori? I reckon there is. I've been called a honky and a cracker before for no reason whatsoever. He was like, "Oh, you white boys don't know what it's like down in Otara, bro." You know.
Yeah, the, I'm sure there are out there. Yeah. And we do take the mickey out of John, but you know he's taking the mickey out of us as well. So he puts up those derogatory cartoons about us. We put them up about him. But you know, it's the game. Yeah, it doesn't mean we hate him.
Yeah. Well, as long as you're having a few laughs and it's all good humoured about it, because, you know, I when he came back, he actually borrowed my camera to take up there to Waitangi, and his assistant wouldn't turn on the camera when they were being roughed up by a couple of Māori guys kind of thing. And it's just like, oh, bro. See, it's when it gets to violence and you're ceasing to talk about it and reconcile differences and understand an issue, as soon as the fists start flying, the debate is over and nobody wins.
They should have welcomed him on to Tea Time Marae. He's interested in the subject. Let him put his voice forward. Yeah.
All right. Well, Joe, Trinda, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today. And we'll put all these archives up on the website, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Ladies and gentlemen, please donate or subscribe if you can. Having trouble paying the bills right now. We'll see you again sometime.
Ka kite, Vinnie.